I thank you very much. My name is Jim Doney, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim! We love you, Jim! Lots and lots and lots! And
I got to tell you that being from a retirement community in Florida, I'm used to meetings that are a little less formal and more enthusiastic. I'm kidding. I've fallen asleep during my own talk down there. I've never been to an Icky Pa convention before. This is my first one. I came in and sat down. You came in and sat down. And you all yelled Icky. And I thought, what the hell do they mean Icky? I haven't opened my mouth yet. I'm a little paranoid about introductions anyway. I used to be on a lecture circuit. Not AA, normal people, lecture circuit. And I seem to be introduction prone. One chairman said, I have an announcement before our speaker. Next month our meeting will be held in the high school auditorium rather than this little church chapel because next month we have a really good speaker and we're expecting a much larger crowd. They got me in the treasurer's report one year. He said, I hate to break this news to you, but the dues are going up so we can get some decent speakers in this place next season. I hadn't even opened my mouth yet. Now you know why I was nervous when you yelled Icky. Another one was the program chairman who said, don't forget it's bingo night. And as soon as the speaker is done, the fun begins. Well, tonight, as soon as the speaker is done, the dance begins, I guess. So I want to thank Ian for the nice introduction. I did question why you would want an old geezer like me as the keynote speaker. Everybody knows that geezers talk too much. They talk about prehistoric stuff. They laugh or cry at anything that happened more than 20 years ago. They're always telling you how good you got it now and how bad they had it then. And never fail to see the contradiction in the fact that they call those days when they had it so bad the good old days. I'm not going to do any of that. Well, I'm going to tell you some things that happened more than 20 years ago. But I'm not going to laugh at them because they weren't very funny. And I'm not going to cry about them either because they're gone. They're past. They're done. It's over. There's nothing I can do about them. And those were not the good old days. I can remember guys that I knew in the program. We called them bleeding deacons in those days. They complained about everything. They complained about any change that took place. They complained when women started to come to the meetings. They complained when young people started to come to the meetings. I can remember people in the program saying, I'm not going to those meetings anymore. There's nothing there but broads and kids. This program has changed a lot, and it's changed for the better. And you are the folks who have changed it. And it's... And these are the good old days. Yeah. Yeah. I know, I'm old, and they're my good days. I can't say I haven't had a couple of better days, but not when I was drinking. I learned something about myself in the last 10 days. Came to a realization about myself that I never had before. I heard when I first came on this program, I had a mentor in the program named Howard Benhoff. wonderful old guy. He was a 20-year man when I came on. He dated back to 1940. And he said that AA was a kindergarten from which we never graduate. And I think it's true because I keep learning new things all the time. And I learned something new about myself. You see, I sat down to write some notes on what I was going to talk about tonight. And I knew that I was supposed to tell you about what my life was like when I drank. And I've done this, I don't know how many times, hundreds of times over the 50 years. And I've always talked about the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking. I guess because I thought that was the worst of my drinking. Or maybe it was because I thought that that's when I crossed that invisible line between alcohol or social drinking and alcoholism. That bothered me for a while when I first came on the program because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I wondered, when did I cross that line and how did I miss it? Why did I cross it? And I eventually learned from someone else in AA that it was a stupid question. It didn't make any difference when I became an alcoholic. What was important was what I was and what kind I was. I was an alcoholic. And there are only two kinds of alcoholics that I know of, drunk ones and sober ones. And I know where the drunk ones are on this Saturday night, generally speaking. I know what they're doing, what they're thinking. I know how they're going to feel tomorrow morning. I know where the sober ones are tonight. I can see a bunch of them. And figuratively speaking, I know where the rest of them are tonight on this Saturday night, too, and how they feel and what they're doing and what they're gonna, how they're going to feel tomorrow morning. And that's the kind of alcoholic I want to be, a sober one. But let's get back to those drinking days. I'm not going to talk about the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking. You and I have a generation gap. In fact, a couple of generations gaps. And that's natural. That's normal. I had generation gaps with my father. I loved Benny Goodman. I grew up in the big band era. He hated Benny Goodman. He disliked Benny Goodman as much as I disliked the music you were playing at the beginning of tonight's meeting. Sorry. But hair. I've said to guys, why don't you get a haircut? You know, and they say, why the hell don't you grow some? You wear baggy clothes to cover a trim figure. I look for trim clothes to cover a baggy figure. These are minor things, though. We have some things in common. So I decided to talk to you tonight about my first 3 or 4 years of drinking and see if there's anything here to which you can relate. Hopefully, you will relate and we'll be on common ground with no generation gap. Okay? I graduated from high school in prehistoric times on June the 5th, 1944, the day before D-Day. Our country was at war. So what else is new? It's always at war, isn't it? But this was, as we geezers call it, the big one. World War II, and it was at the height of World War II. D-Day was the culmination. And we were fighting on two oceans. Everybody 17 years old about to graduate from high school and about to turn 18 knew that they were either going to be drafted or they were going to enlist in the armed forces. They were going to be trained and sent off to war and possibly killed before their 19th birthday. That was a fact of life that was inescapable. And so there was an attitude among some of us, which I thought at that time was a reason, which I have learned since was just an excuse. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. And that's the way we felt. And there was a group in my school that drank and partied. And I joined that group purposely because I wanted to be like them. And I wanted to party with them. I lost some friends as a result of drinking because not all the kids felt that way. We were the fast crowd. And there were the squares who didn't think we were doing the right thing. So I lost some friends, and I had to lie to my parents about where I'd been, what I'd been doing, who I was with. But that's the crowd I wanted to be with. We used to get a couple of six-packs and go to somebody's house and play poker in the afternoon, drink beer, or somebody'd steal from their parents' liquor locker. We'd get it somewhere, somehow. The legal drinking age in Ohio, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in a suburb of Cleveland. The legal drinking age was 21, but nobody enforced it in those days, especially during the war. Nobody ever carded us or asked us our age. And we found, my best friend and I, found an Italian restaurant where you could get a good plate of spaghetti and a bottle of beer for a buck. We sure beat the cafeteria food, I'll tell you. And the problem was it was kind of far away from the school. My friend had a car and gas ration stamps, which were even more important, and we could get to that Italian restaurant, but we had to cut the last class in the morning to give us time to get there. The last class before lunch was hygiene taught by the football coach. We cut that class so much that I don't know to this day what the hell that class was all about. Maybe why my wife said when I was drinking that I had poor hygiene. I don't know. But anyway, he could have stopped us from graduating because it was a required course. He called us in. We had a stern reprimand. He finally gave us a passing grade, a D grade, but at least we passed and got our diploma. And the only reason he did it was because he knew we were going in the service, and he didn't want to screw up our graduation. Of that group that started in high school, my best friend and the best man at my wedding committed suicide at the age of 32. Another one died of exposure and pneumonia at the age of 34 after living outdoors one whole winter on Lake Erie in the winter in the ice and snow. Another one was killed, I don't know how old, but in his late 20s, in a drunken automobile accident. Another two, I don't know what ever happened to them. I'm the only one that made it in AA, as far as I know. And it was very lucky. I was lucky in another way, although I didn't feel lucky. I got turned down by the draft. I'm almost blind in my right eye, so I was declared a 4F, which was disabled, unable to serve. I didn't like that because I wanted to serve. We all did. That was the war psychology. We wanted to get in there and do our part. We wanted to be a man. And there was a stigma attached even to being a 4F, even to being disabled. Draft dodger, slacker. That was the feeling. So I tried to join everything, even tried to join the Merchant Marine, but nobody would take me. So it was decided by family vote that I would go to college. It was 2-1 against me. I didn't want to go to college, but my parents decided I would go to college. My father decided I would study business and finance. My father was a banker. He was not a college graduate. He saw young college graduates passing him up. And so he thought the key to success was that diploma, that degree. And I was to become a businessman. I didn't want to be a businessman. I wanted to be a disc jockey. I wanted to be a radio announcer. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do from the time I was 13 years old. I had a high school teacher that encouraged me. He had worked in radio, and he got me a job as part-time office boy in a radio station. He taught me about radio. We set up a radio station on the PA system in high school and did daily newscasts. I did stuff on a radio, an FM radio station owned by the Board of Education, an educational station. Radio was all I wanted to do. I loved radio. If I couldn't get on the radio, I wanted to be an actor or a performer of some kind. If I couldn't do that, I wanted to write. But I signed up at Western Reserve University in the business course because that's what my father wanted. I learned how to play bridge at the Wade Drugstore. I learned how to drink beer at Maury's Bar on campus. I learned nothing about astronomy and flunked it. I learned nothing about biology and flunked it. I learned nothing about basic accounting and flunked it. I got a good grade in English composition because I liked it and I worked at it. And I got a good grade in theater arts because I liked it and I worked at it. I joined a fraternity which was known as we called ourselves the Singing Betas. We were known on campus as the Drunken Betas. My mother, we couldn't afford a college education on my dad's salary. My mother had gone back to work to earn the money to pay my tuition. And at the end of that school year, I had to bring home a report card showing her that I had flunked the three major courses that I was taking. And that's where her money was going. I was so ashamed of that. I was working at a job on weekends at a Fisher Body plant in Cleveland to earn spending money. Read that, beer money. Made 40 cents an hour working in the office. And they had a lot of fancy equipment, and I forged a report card on Western Reserve University letterhead and mailed it to myself from a box on campus so it would have the right postmark and send it to my home so that I could open it up and show my mother what a wonderful thing her money had bought, my passing grades in my year in college. In the meantime, I had contacted an agent who specialized in placing inexperienced radio people in small-town radio stations in Ohio, and he had arranged for me to go to work at WMAN Mansfield, a city of about 70,000 people, a little 250-watt radio station. I worked a 40-hour week for $40 a week, a dollar an hour. Disc jockeys didn't get rich in those days. That's maybe what attracted them to a little payola on the side from time to time. But anyway, I went to Mansfield at the age of 19, told my parents it was a summer job only and I'd be back. I knew that wasn't true. I was never going back to college. The war ended while I was working at that radio station. I still have the Associated Press headline, "Truman announces Japanese surrender." I still have it in my papers at home. I read it on the air that day. The war was over. In the meantime, I had been drinking a lot in Mansfield, even on $40 a week. It wasn't quite enough to buy what I really wanted, as much as I wanted. So another fellow and I had worked out a system where we were stealing booze at a local bar. The guy had a tiny little bar, and he stored his booze in a space in the men's room. He had fenced it off with chicken wire. And we could wiggle bottles through that chicken wire. We couldn't carry them out the front door. So we opened a window and set them on a shelf out there in an alley next to the bar. When we left, we'd go down the alley, pick the bottle off the sill, and take it home. And that's how we drank. Mansfield Reformatory is a prison. And we were flirting with Mansfield Reformatory. And to give you an idea of what we were flirting with, if you've ever seen the movie Shawshank Redemption, it was filmed in the Mansfield Reformatory. It is a full-on penitentiary, a real birdcage of a place. And we risked that for a bottle of booze. And I hung around with a band. I became a groupie with a little four-piece band. And they befriended me, and they bought me a lot of beers. And I liked that life. I was doing all right. I was okay at the radio station. I had a nice room. I only paid $6 a week for it. I ate twice a day at Happy Harry's Diner and pretty good home cooking. And I was happy doing that. And at the end of that summer, I had to write my parents a letter and sort of resign from the family and tell them I wasn't coming back. They didn't accept that. They drove down, took me to dinner. It turned out my father was much more reasonable than I thought he would be, and they agreed that I should follow my own course. And we were a family again. They were very understanding. They were very nice parents. Then a funny thing happened to me. I got drafted. Just when I didn't want to, I was launching my big radio career. They were sending home all the troops. The war was over. But they needed occupation troops. And they were even taking 4Fs for that. And I was reclassified 1A and drafted into the Army Air Corps. I took basic training in Amarillo, Texas, got sent to a radar school in Boca Raton, Florida, that had been closed for several months. Communications were not real good in the Army in those days. I then got on a troop train, spent 10 days crossing the country to Fairfield, California, where we were supposed to ship out by air to Japan. Instead, we were confiscated by the fire chief, 10 of us, out of the terminal, because we'd been weathered in for a couple of days, and this civilian fire chief came through and took 10 of us to the firehouse, gave us 2 weeks of training, a bed, and decent meals, and we became crash firemen. And that's where I spent the next year at Travis, what's now Travis Air Force Base, driving a fire truck. I couldn't drink much. I only got $21 a month in the Army. And the beer at the PX was only 10 cents a bottle, I think. I got a little in, but not very much. I remember once I saw an ad in the Vallejo newspaper. An American Legion post was holding a big party of some kind. Active servicemen, booze was free. Oh, boy, were those welcome words. Couldn't wait to get to Vallejo and the booze is free party. I did not know, but I found out in a hurry, that Vallejo is a Navy town. And Army Air Corps guys were not real welcome. I don't know how much I drank. I don't know what happened at that party. I remember going, and the next thing I remember is waking up or coming out of a blackout in the bus dispatcher's office complaining that a woman bus driver had tried to run over me. And the man was laughing because he didn't have any women bus drivers. I was missing my hat and tie. I had a big cut over my eye. I had no money. I'd been rolled. And I had been in a fight, obviously, and I obviously was not the winner of the fight. Or if I was the winner, the loser was dead. I'll tell you, anybody that came out of that fight in worse shape than I was couldn't have survived. I'm not kidding about that. That bus driver gave me a ticket and got me back on base, and I got straightened out. But I never went back to Vallejo, California, because I did not know whether I was wanted in that town or not. I did not know what happened. Never knew. I got released in April of 1947. I had some relatives in Fresno. I went down to visit them before I came home. They had a date all arranged for me, some girl they knew that was about my age. I don't even remember what she looked like or her name. I got drunk at the party they threw and passed out, had another blackout, woke up throwing up in their bathtub. That was a visit to my aunt and uncle in Fresno. They threw me out pretty quick. And I came home to Cleveland, back with my parents. In April of 1947, I had become a liar, a cheat, a thief, embarrassed, humiliated, degraded. I had almost flunked out of high school. I had flunked out of college. I had had 2 alcoholic blackouts. And I was 2 months short of my 21st birthday. I was not yet able to drink legally. Do we have anything in common, folks? I was an alcoholic when I took that first drink that first night because I had to lie to my parents about where I was and what I was doing, who I was with. A normal social drinker does not have to lie about the first drink they take. That's when I crossed the line, when I picked up the first drink, and I became an alcoholic. The next 13 or 14 years are kind of a blur. I did graduate from that radio station to Youngstown, back to Cleveland finally, where I was a disc jockey on a suburban station for 4 years. I made the transition into television, worked at 2 different TV stations, settled down with the CBS station, and did very well. for a while. I hosted game shows. I did commercials. I replaced Paul Newman on a television commercial. I never met him, but I replaced him on a commercial, and you can be damn sure that went in my resume. And I was second banana on another audience participation show, did a lot of commercial stuff, and was finally assigned as anchor on the weekend news, Saturday and Sunday night, sponsored by Household Finance Corporation. And I acquired a wife who wished me dead, a daughter who was afraid of me and ran and hide when I came home, a mother-in-law who was a witch, a car that was smashed up, and it was in a long line of smashed up cars. And I finally just ran out of everything. It was all trouble now, nothing else. I had been taken off the air almost completely, stuck in the basement of the station on a typewriter writing promotional material. The only reason I stayed on the news is because the sponsor insisted. I don't know why they stuck with me, but they did. But my boss didn't. And he finally said there was no room on the staff anymore for a drunken announcer. He'd been very patient with me for a long time. I can remember those nights when I tried to do the news, and I would try to drink enough that my hands wouldn't shake when I was on the air, but not so much that my speech would be slurred. And, you know, that magic moment became harder and harder to reach, especially on Sunday, because of the blue laws in Ohio. You could only get 3-2 beer, near beer, on Sunday. I had to really plan Sundays out carefully in advance in order to keep the edge so my hands wouldn't shake, but my speech wasn't slurred. But I managed to do that for a while, but finally got just laid off. The boss said, go home, don't come back until you can come back sober, and give us some indication that you can stay that way. I didn't even tell my wife I'd been laid off. I thought I'd go to work for another station immediately. I thought I was indispensable. I had called and made an appointment, went in for an interview, and I got the don't call us, we'll call you story. And everybody knows what that means. It means they ain't ever going to call you. They don't want you. You're done. I left that, went back home, and I was sick, and I had no place to go. A man called me. He was in my business. He identified himself as an AA. I didn't know that. But he offered to help, and I told him I didn't need any help and hung up on him. Another man came to the house and got in because he had talked to my wife first, and she let him in. In fact, she invited him in. His name was Ellis. He was a lawyer. He sat at my bed and told me his story. And I don't know how or why he did it, but he talked me into going to Rosary Hall in St. Vincent Charity Hospital. It was run by Sister Ignatia. And I packed up my stuff, and I went with him to Rosary Hall. We walked in the door, and I saw a nun walk by in the black habit, and I thought, oh, my God, it's a religious sect. I'm here to be brainwashed. I'm going to end up kissing the Pope's ring. Let me out. I grew up in a sort of Baptist Presbyterian family, and in those days, among some Protestants, strong feelings that the church basements of the Catholic churches were full of arms and ammunition, and they were going to take over the government. My grandmother believed that, and I grew up in that atmosphere. And when I saw a nun, I thought, oh, my God, I'm in the middle of a revolution. Actually, it was the religion that bothered me, because I was not in any way religious. I had turned my back on the church, and I'd never had any training or experience in church, none that I enjoyed or none that I thought was valuable. And I really felt uncomfortable. But I was already in the pink pajamas with the big RH on them, and they wouldn't let me out. They wouldn't give me my clothes. They said only Sister Ignatia could give me my clothes and let me go home. And she wasn't there, so she couldn't do it. I'd have to wait. Well, I didn't want to be there, so I imagined I was on a boat. I kept asking people how long they'd been aboard and which way's the galley and stuff like that. I don't know where I got that. I'd never been in a boat in my life except the Aquarama, which was a cruise that went all the way up to Detroit and back, and I was drunk the whole time I was on that, so I didn't learn any nautical language. So the next thing I decided was that I was, here is an undercover reporter. You know, the guy that gets checks himself into a mental institution so he can report on how he's really treated by these people. I was going to write an expose of this crooked nun and this operation she was running up here. And I don't know where I was going to report that. I didn't have a job. But that didn't make any difference to me. I was nuttier than a fruitcake, as I think back on it. The next delusion was that I'd been kidnapped and I was being held for ransom. And these nuns and nurses joined together in a plot to rob us of the last vestige of our life savings. My life savings at the moment being 12 empty whiskey bottles in the trunk of a beat-up Chevy. And everybody knows what a Catholic nun will do to get her hands on 12 empty liquor bottles. I remember my last drink very well. It was Old Bardwell and Peraldehyde. Not formaldehyde, peraldehyde. That was supposed to ward off the DTs. The alcohol worked. I felt pretty good when I had that last drink. The peraldehyde did not work, and I went into DTs that night. It was a scene across the street from the hotel. I was in no danger myself. But it was a gang fight over there with people being killed with knives and guns and chains. And they were all singing. I can even remember some of the songs. It was sort of like West Side Story, only with real weapons. And none of the other guys in the ward wanted to watch. Now, I'd had some experience doing a little play-by-play sports along the line, so I did a blow-by-blow description of the fight in the parking lot for the rest of the guys. And there was one fellow from Youngstown who told me later that he knew I was in DTs, but it sounded so good he got up and looked anyway. But there was nothing there. It was an empty parking lot. And I sat up and watched it all night. They gave me orange juice with something in it that morning, and I went to sleep. And when I woke up, there was a nurse in the room. I was the only one in there. And the nurse kidded me about the show I'd seen out the window and asked me if I was going to put it on TV. And I said to her, "Do you mean it wasn't really there?" She said, "What do you think, Jim?" And walked out. And I sat in the bed by myself. And you know, that's the first time anybody had asked me what I thought for a long time. Everybody I knew had told me what they thought of me. My wife, my boss, my parents, even my six-year-old daughter. But nobody had asked me what I thought of me. And I took an inventory that day without even knowing it was one of our steps, because I hadn't been reading the literature. I hadn't been listening to any of the people talking to me. I had been fighting it all the way. I didn't know anything about AA. But I sat on the bed and really told myself the honest-to-God truth. That I was a drunken bum. I had become a bad father, a bad worker, a bad husband, a bad man, a bad citizen, a bad everything. And I didn't like it. And I hoped I could do something about it. Sister Ignatia gave me a Sacred Heart, told me I had to give it back to her before I took a drink. She gave me a little booklet called Confidence in God. I said, I was looking for you 2 or 3 days ago, and they told me you weren't here. She said, "No, they told you I wasn't available." I said, "Well, does that mean you weren't here?" She said, "No, I was here the whole time. I just wasn't available. I was in the chapel." She said, "I was praying for you, and I knew with your attitude about religion, that's the last place you'd look." I left Rosary Hall, and the sign over the door said, "Take hope, all ye who leave here." And I started to go to meetings with the hope that these people knew what the hell they were talking about. And it turned out they did. I didn't think anybody knew I was an alcoholic except my own family. First meeting I walked into, I heard a woman's voice in the room above all others, which said, "They got him." She was the teller in the bank where I cashed my paychecks. One look at my checking account, she knew I was an alcoholic. She was not in the program. Her husband was. She was in Al-Anon. I went to a morning meeting, and a big black guy came running across the room at me. I was afraid he was going to hit me. He threw his arms around me, and he said, "You're Jim Doney, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I've been praying for you." And I said, "That's nice, but why? I never saw you before in my life." He said, "My son Calvin works in the garage where you park your car. And he come home and tell me, oh, Mr. Doney had a load on tonight. We hated to give him his car." And I can remember Calvin used to buy me coffee and pretend my car was stuck in someplace behind other cars and they had trouble getting it out. They would delay me and try to sober me up before they'd give me my car. And I was so mad at those guys, those kids, for doing that to me every night. And here this Calvin would do that and then go home and tell his father what he had done. And his father said he prayed that I'd get home safe and then prayed that I'd come to this program eventually. And he said, "My prayers have been answered." Now, my wife thought her prayers had been answered, and my mother thought her prayers had been answered. That guy was sure his prayers had been answered. I don't know whose prayers were answered, but I'm sure glad somebody's were. After one or two meetings, we were cleaning up after a meeting one night. It was an open meeting. My wife went with me to meetings, and somebody handed me a broom, and I knew what to do with it. I started sweeping the floor. I didn't mind. Everybody was doing something to help clean up. But I looked over in the corner. My wife was talking to my sponsor, and they were looking at me and laughing. And I didn't think it was very funny. And I swept over into their area, and I said, "What the hell's so funny?" And my wife said, "I was just telling Ken that it was only a couple of weeks ago that I told you that if you didn't quit drinking, you'd end up sweeping floors someplace." And I remember she had said that, and it struck me funny. And they were laughing with me, not at me. And it was fun. I found out being sober can be fun. There was one man in my home group that I didn't like much. I was willing to love him like a brother, but I didn't really want to sit next to him at meetings. He always looked kind of messy to me. I had heard he'd been sentenced to AA by some judge. 90 days or 90 meetings. 90 days meant 90 days in the workhouse. And he had chosen the meetings, and I figured as soon as his 90 days were up, he'd be drinking. I was judging him and his sobriety. The first Christmas that I was sober, I got a call on Christmas Day. I came in the program in September. It's now 3 months later. And it was my sponsor who said, "We've got to go to a funeral home." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Tony W.'s son has been hit by a drunken driver and killed, and we've got to go stand by Tony." Tony was the guy, a long Polish name. I said, "That's the last place in the world I want to be." And my sponsor said, "It's the last place in the world I want to be, too. But that's where we belong, so that's where we're going. I'll pick you up in 10 minutes. And he did, and we went. And I was sure I would see Tony, a drunken wreck. I was sure of it. And I didn't want to see that. We went in the funeral home, and there was Tony, well-dressed, very neat, in control. And he stood at the casket of his son. And he told us that he'd also lost a son in the Korean War. And he said, "At least I am grateful that this boy knew me as a sober father for the last 5 years. Tony had 5 years of sobriety. And he was grateful to AA for those 5 years that his son had known him as a sober father. Tony, at that moment, changed from a man I didn't like much to a man I wanted to be like. I thought, there's a real man. What is it that allows him to handle this tragedy that way? Whatever it is, I want some of that. Tony became an example to me of what a real man is. And we became close friends. And I sat as close to Tony from that time on as I could get. And walked with Tony as far as I could walk. So that's how I came into AA. And what happened when I got here now? Well, there have been a lot of results. If I had made a bucket list at that time of what I wanted to do before I died, I would have shortchanged myself. I could never even have imagined the things that have happened to me in the last 50 years. Things that came back to me. My reputation, for example. There's a street in Cleveland called Vincent Avenue. They used to call it Short Vincent. It had one decent nightclub with top-notch entertainment, a top-notch tasty barbecue restaurant, barbecue chicken and ribs, and a whole bunch of sleazy B-club, B-girl bars. That was Short Vincent. The tasty barbecue was a very good place. They did their biggest business 2:30 and 3 o'clock in the morning because that's when the bars closed and everybody would stop for a late-night supper. On a Saturday night, I found myself coming out of a blackout, laying on the floor at the front door of the tasty barbecue restaurant with people stepping over me. And I was not exactly an anonymous drunk. They, as they stepped over me, said things like, "That's Jim Doan. He does the news on Channel 8, doesn't he?" "What's new, Jim?" You know. Remember how embarrassed, how humiliated I was. I don't remember getting off. I had done the news that night at 11 o'clock. 4 hours later, I was on the floor with people stepping over me. And I remember how humiliated I was, but I don't remember how I got home that night. 15 years later, it was announced in the newspaper that I was leaving Cleveland and I'd taken a job in Honolulu, Hawaii. City Council passed a resolution commending me for contributions to the radio and television business in the city of Cleveland and had me down for a session of the City Council with my family and presented me with a beautiful plaque. The City Hall is only 2 blocks from the Tasty Barbecue Restaurant. 2 blocks and 15 years from the barbecue restaurant. 15 years of sobriety. A couple of years ago, I was inducted in the Ohio Radio and Television Broadcasters Hall of Fame. A man that I sponsored went into it the year before I did. The Hall of Fame is in Akron, Ohio, just a few blocks from Dr. Bob's house. Don't think we didn't talk about that, too. My wife admitted to me that she wished me dead at one time. Not from a drunken accident where some innocent people might get killed. She hoped I would die of a nice, respectable heart attack. Get good press, you know, and not a lot of scandal. After I'd been sober for a year or so, somebody said to her, "It must be nice to have the old Jim back." And she said, "No. This is not the old Jim. He was drinking when I married him. This is a whole new person." My wife thought of me as a whole new person after I got sober. Just before she died, on Valentine's Day, we were watching TV, and the woman was complaining on there about her husband didn't send her a Valentine. And I had bought my wife a little gift and given it to her. And she looked at the TV and said to the TV, but in a loud voice, loud enough for me to hear, "That's because you didn't marry a nice guy like I did." 3 days later, she was gone. But that moment will always be with me. My parents, my mother and father, my mother, they always went to California in the summer on their vacations. One year they had a slight accident. It wasn't an accident, really. It was some motor problem with the plane. They had to make an emergency landing. And it was a scary thing, but they were not really in any danger. When they got back, they were telling us all about it. And my mother said, that serenity prayer really works, doesn't it? I said, you know the serenity prayer? And she said, yes. And I said, where did you learn the serenity prayer? And she said, oh, I don't know. I must have read it someplace. And my father spoke up and said, she's read everything she can get her hands on Alcoholics Anonymous. She knows more about it than you do. She also told me that they now enjoyed their vacations in California because they were no longer worried about what trouble I was getting into back in Cleveland. I had no idea I was ruining their vacation every year for all those years, but I did. My father, who thought getting paid for talking was almost a sin, I sat and was telling him a story about a guy I was sponsoring. This guy, I brought him home out of Rosary Hall and took him home, and his dog didn't recognize him sober and bit him. Honest to God truth. And I was telling my father about that, and he suddenly reached over and grabbed my hand in both of his. And he said, you know, you can do something that very few people can do. You now have the power to help people. Some people that nobody else knows what to do with, knows how to fix. You can help them. So that's a wonderful ability you now have. And he had a look in his eye that showed some pride in his only son for the first time. And that was a wonderful result of sobriety. There are no rewards for sobriety. Sobriety is its own reward, just like virtue is its own reward. What you get for being sober is sober. And that's plenty. But there are plenty of results. My daughter doesn't run and hide from me anymore. She better not. Tomorrow she's going to buy me dinner because it's Father's Day. She's up in Rome, and my daughter is now widowed as of about a year and a few months ago. And the house that I live in Florida is our house. We bought it together. It will eventually be her retirement home, too. Her kids, my grandchildren, are in Fort Myers. So they come up, and she comes down, and we all get together in the villages where I live for holidays and vacations and that sort of thing. And it works out very well. But my daughter and I are very close. When she graduated from high school, she came off the stage, and we congratulated her, of course. And she said, do you realize, Dad, you haven't had a drink the whole time I was in school. I got out of Rosary Hall the day she started in the first grade. And I said, this is your day, you know, your accomplishments. Why are you thinking about that? And she said, we talked about that in school a lot. That a lot of the girls couldn't have pajama parties, couldn't have me over to their home, because they never knew what condition their parents would be in. They never knew what shape mom or dad would be in when they just dropped in on them. But she said, I could always bring my friends home to you, to our house, because I knew they'd be welcome, and I knew you'd be okay. There was a lot of trust, and that was a wonderful feeling that she felt that way about her father, the one that used to hide when I came by. I was known as the station lush at the TV station where I worked. A guy hit me with a big door one day accidentally, and instead of saying, excuse me, he said, gee whiz, Jim, I hope I didn't break your flask. I lived with that kind of sarcasm, pity, and contempt from other people. On my first birthday in AA, I came to work. I got my job back, incidentally. And on my first day back, or the one-year anniversary, there was a little birthday cake on my desk with one candle in it and a bottle of Pepsi. My co-workers, who I at one time was very mad at and didn't like and didn't think they liked me, remembered it was my first anniversary in AA and had a little cake for me. And we had become close, of course. I started to do I got to tell you one other story. They gave me an assignment. They decided to do a documentary on drugs. And Art Linkletter came to town. his daughter committed suicide, and he blamed drugs for it. And he wanted to take part in this program. And my boss knew him. And so I was assigned to work with Art Linkletter and a group called Dust, which was a band. They were all former addicts, and they specialized in playing high school assemblies and preaching the no-drug habits. And we did a special that ran on many stations around the country, and it was wonderful working with Art Linkletter for a week and very closely with him. I took him to his first AA meeting. I found an open meeting, and he wanted to see what went on in AA. And I took him to a meeting, and he was very impressed. And it was one of those things I never would have put on my bucket list. I started to do a program called Adventure Road, which was assigned to me. It was a program of travel and adventure films. There are 35-millimeter slides that they use to promote TV shows and so forth. Usually they have the names of the show, plus a number, because it's a series of slides. The slides for Adventure Road should have been AR1, AR2, AR3, etc. Somewhere in the projection department, they got labeled AA1, AA2, AA3. And they presented them to me in a little ceremony in the projection department. It was an honor. Adventure Road lasted 12 years. It sent me all over the world. Again, the bucket list. I've been to Machu Picchu. I've seen the Taj Mahal. I've seen Mount Fujiyama. I've been to a meeting in London. I've been to a meeting in Buenos Aires. I've been to a meeting in Montreal. I went to a meeting in Japan and didn't understand a word that was spoken and came away feeling as good as I'll feel when I walk out of this meeting tonight. I could follow what was going on. I could tell when they were doing the Serenity Prayer. I could tell when they were doing the Lord's Prayer. Somehow, I followed the speaker. I was laughing at his jokes. I don't know. Everybody else was laughing, so I laughed. But it was the feeling that was in the room that was important. It wasn't what was said. It was the feeling that was there, the group. And it was wonderful. I moved to Hawaii and went to work for the CBS station there. I was there 25 years. In Hawaii, I got a chance to test out those acting skills that I almost flunked out at Eldred Theater at Western Reserve University. Ended up playing a doctor on Hawaii Five-O on a number of episodes. I worked for the CBS station there locally. I was assigned to work with Steve Allen and his wife Jane Meadows on a special, which was a cultural exchange with the People's Republic of China. They had recorded on tape a Chinese comic opera that was recorded in the Royal Palace in Beijing. And what we did was record Steve Allen and Jane Meadows in Queen Emma's Summer Palace in Honolulu, Steve Allen commenting on the comedy aspects of this opera, and Jane Meadows interpreting the lyrics. Jane Meadows speaks fluent Mandarin Chinese, and so does her sister Audrey Meadows up from the Honeymooners. They grew up in China. They were daughters of a missionary, and she wore a traditional Chinese costume. It was a beautiful show. You can now rent it. A university owns that show. I didn't make it in college, but one of my productions did. And it's for rent. I warn you, if you ever rent it, you'll hate the music. It's really poor. The hardest part of the program for me was the spiritual aspect. My aversion to religion got in the way. I was too dumb and too egotistical to be able to even imagine a power greater than myself, believe it or not. That seems strange to me to even say nowadays. There's so many powers in the world that are greater than myself. There's a power called synergy. It's a Greek word. It means working together. And the truth of synergy is the fact that a group of people working together can accomplish what each individual cannot accomplish on their own. Man has always known that. That's why we divided up originally into tribes. It's why we have armies. It's why we have symphony orchestras. It's why we have football teams. It's why we have AA groups. Because the group can accomplish what the individuals cannot accomplish on their own. So for me, the group became my higher power for a while. And I still think it's a good higher power. It certainly is one higher than me, because there I could do things I couldn't do alone. There is another power higher than me and you, which science does not understand, cannot explain, but it affects everything I do 24 hours a day, and it affects everything you do 24 hours a day. It's called gravity. You can buy that, can't you? Do you know that scientists cannot explain gravity? They don't know what it is. They don't know where it came from. They don't know why it exists. All they know is what it does. There was a recent research project launched to try to learn more about gravity. If you Google gravity, you'll get a million and one theories of what it is, but finally you'll come to one item that says, frankly, we don't know. And they don't. But it's a powerful force, isn't it? A power that keeps us from spinning off into space. We're on a ball that's spinning at 1,000 miles an hour up the equator, going 670,000 miles an hour through space around the sun. The moon is there and stays in orbit, and it's all because of gravity. We don't fly off. The Earth doesn't fly off. The moon doesn't fly off. It's such a powerful force that moves the oceans on a regular, predictable schedule. So if there can be that kind of a force, physical, that science doesn't understand, why can't there be a power greater than myself that keeps me with both feet solid on the ground, mentally, emotionally, in sobriety? There is such a power. I'm sure of it now. It was in that little pamphlet Sister Ignatia gave me, Confidence in God. I don't know what that power is. I call it God so you'll understand what I mean by the power greater than myself. I don't know if it's a he, she, or an it. I'm not supposed to know. It's not important to know. All I know is it's there and it works. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. The first Christmas party I went to sober was thrown by my boss. It was a Christmas party for radio and TV and newspaper people. My boss worked in the newspaper business. He tried to get us together once a year because there's no love lost between those two groups. And there was going to be a round of sparkling burgundy served, toasts made, and actually it was a roast. These guys threw barbs at each other across the table in the toasts. Whoever got in the biggest insult won for the night. So, for the day, a luncheon thing. I didn't want to go to that because I was afraid of ending up with a glass of red wine sitting in front of me, pointing at the one that had the problem. I wasn't going to drink it. Everybody else's glass would be empty, and here'd be my wine blinking on and off like a red neon sign, pointing at the guy with the problem. Well, it came time for the drinks to be served and the toasts to be made, and the two guys serving it came down the line, and they went by me so fast I couldn't even smell the cork on the bottle. My glass was turned up. The guy wiped it out, turned it back upside down, and went right on by me. I never got a glass of wine. I toasted with my water glass. Nobody noticed. The toasts were about my news show, but nothing personal. The guys were very kind to me that day. And I found the waiter later, and I said, "Did my boss tell you to do that?" And he said, "Hell no. I saw you at a meeting Tuesday night." Now, I went home and told my sponsor, "Boy, what a coincidence. I drew an AA waiter, and he went right down my throat." "What do you mean, coincidence? Did you say your prayer?" I said, "Yes, I did." "I said, what did you ask for?" I said, "Well, I usually say, originally I said, 'Dear God, if there is one, But I graduated to just, God, I'm Jim Doney. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to stay sober today. I will do my best. But help me if I get in trouble, or show me the way if I get lost. He said, okay, you asked for help, you got help. Go home and thank them. That's the way this program works. And I did. And he was right. That's the way this program works. It's happened to me over and over and over again. So many times that I can't deny it anymore. I cannot write it off as coincidence. A young Chinese guide in Hong Kong that I worked with when I was making one of the travelogues noticed I didn't drink. And said, he asked me if I ever drank, and I said, I once did, but I don't anymore. He said, you must be an AA. Now, Hong Kong was a city of like 2 million people at that time, and there were only 10 AAs listed in the World Directory, 10 individuals. And here's a 21-year-old college kid who recognized me as an AA, and I said, where did you learn about AA? And he said, we learned about it in college, in a textbook. And then he told me his father was an alcoholic who died from alcoholism. And he was saying, how lucky you are. How happy you must be. You're from a city where they have AA. How grateful you must be. I went back to my hotel, and believe it or not, they had a drawing, room keys, and I won a bottle of scotch. And I just handed it back to the guy, and I said, better give that to somebody that can use it. Don't drink. And I had heard those words at lunch that day from that Chinese guide. Now, who would expect a 21-year-old Chinese kid in Hong Kong to be delivering the message to me that I needed that day? But it was there. It's there so much, so often, so well, that I look for it all the time. I sometimes find it in the newspaper. I hear it on the radio. I see it on TV. I can pick up the morning paper and read two stories on the front page and say, thank God, I'm so grateful that's not me. Because at one time my boss paid our promotion department to try to keep my name out of the paper. All right, I find it in the horoscopes. I've even found it in the comic pages. It's there somewhere. Because that's the way it works. Now, I don't have any magic words, and I don't know anything that you don't know about staying sober. Even after 50 years, I'm still learning about myself and about the program. So there's no magic, nothing that I can leave you with, except a request. I'm going to ask you to go on enjoying Ikipa. Enjoy the camaraderie. Enjoy the companionship. Enjoy what this organization obviously is doing for you. It looks like so much fun. I wish I was young again and I could join you here in this. But please don't make it your only AA activity. Go to mainstream meetings where us old geezers are, because we need you there. You're not only welcome there and wanted there, you're needed there. I mean that. Shannon today spoke in a panel up here. She talked about how nice the old guys were to her in her home group. And I know it. I know that feeling because they need her at that meeting. We need your experience, strength, and hope. You may think that that's something that's handed down from one generation to another. It's not. Experience, strength, and hope is a two-way street that we exchange with each other. Your experience is an example to us that this program is still working the way it should, dynamic and wonderfully. Three guys got books tonight. That's an example to me. This program works. Strength, remember, old geezers are whining. Strength is waning a bit. There are some physical things to do at meetings, and you've got the strength to do it. But there's another kind of strength that you have. As you work the program one day at a time, I know there are tough days, and there are days when it takes a lot of strength to get through that day without a drink, that kind of strength. That's important for us to see and to know, too. Because as I get older and the longer I'm in the program, my enemies are apathy and overconfidence. I cannot let down. I've got to see that effort on your part every day to remind me that I must make the effort every day to stay sober one day at a time. And the hopes, well, we all share the hopes. We all hope for a better life, of course, for all of us. For sobriety, for sanity, for serenity. And I have one more personal hope for you. I hope that your higher power is as good to you as mine has been to me. Thank you, Ichabod.